trying to escape is futile. Who child is time to juggle in 2 hours? That's why we got more than 2 styles. To a death in the situation is too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child, we will survive. It is time to build a nest. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom." And with all that getting, get an understanding. Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to OurRadioNetwork.com. Again, that's OurRadioNetwork.com. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream your program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. And that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll see interesting content always posted by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening Media is there, always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening Media. Interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening Marketplace and our partnership with the BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:07 here in the city of Philadelphia on this cold Sunday evening, or chilly Sunday evening, and we're in the Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Tonight we have a panel of four special guests and an interesting topic to match. Researcher, author, Sister Lorraine Muhammad is with us. African Esquire TV host, Sister Tierney Cherie is also with us. Organizer, journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Egbona Jr. is with us. And NC State educational psychology major, Miss Taylor Cummings, is with us to talk about an interesting topic tonight, an African-centered perspective on U.S.-African foreign policy. And we'll get into that subject, and it should be interesting because, during the dog and pony show that was the presidential elections here in the country, black surrogates, black elected officials went out to all corners of the country where our people was at, whether it was urban or rural, and basically told them that their mission was to get Trump out of office. No policies were discussed, and especially foreign policies was not discussed. The only thing that was pushed was to get Trump out of office. The thing we like to do on this program is to delve into things that maybe our people are not familiar with, information that they're not given by the blackness leadership class, and subjects that we need to talk about as a collective. Tonight is one of them. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your hosts, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
You know what, Elliot? I'm doing fine. Even the chill is not bothering me right now, because I really believe that our, you know, the discussion we're having, going to have tonight, is like, I don't want to say those flowery things, critical, important, necessary for African people. I want to say all that. It's it came to my, like, as you said, through this whole thing about this election, power politics was not taught from, you know, from the perspective I was looking at it, because there was no foreign policy talk as it relates to the Black community, as it relates to the Pan-Africanist community. And I'm very concerned about us who identify ourselves in a geopolitical sense as Pan-Africanists, because in this moment, we really have to be able to, you know, across generations, show our political maturity. So I'm really excited to engage, not like I understand what I'm saying or understand what that means, power politics or, you know, political maturity as it relates to being a Pan-Africanist. But I think that what we should do, and for the Time for Awakening audience to do, is be able to engage in that conversation. Because obviously there's something, when they don't show it, that means there must be some importance to it. And when it gets to African, when it gets to foreign policy as it relates to Africa and the diaspora, as African people in the diaspora, you notice there's no, this was silence. And so I'm really excited about that.
And, you know, just looking into this topic and subject, seeing the people involved, especially people that look like myself and you, Brother Richard, it shows me the urgency and the importance that we really have to unify, develop operational unity among ourselves in order to move our people towards freedom. Because the Europeans that have kept our people enslaved since we've been on these shores have really developed a strategy where they can, in their minds, cut us off at the pass and attack us from all angles.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll see more about it as we delve into this topic tonight with our special guest that'll be joining us. And Brother Obi Agbona Jr. will be joining us a little bit later, probably in 8 o'clock hour. He'll add a wealth of knowledge, a historical perspective in dealing with this subject from personal and from his father's experience, which is a wealth of knowledge you'll find out once he joins us dealing with this topic of U.S. foreign policy, being a U.S. correspondent to the Herald, and like I said, you know, being able to experience some of these things firsthand. Some of our guests tonight, research and author Larry Muhammad has been on with us before. The book Black Integration: A Failed Social Experiment was an exciting show when she was on with us. I'm glad to have her back. She'll be joining us. African Esquire TV host Sister Tierney Cherie is with us. And also NC State educational psychology major Sister Taylor Cummings will be joining us to give a psychological inroads to some of the thinking that is required looking at this from an African-centered perspective and looking at it from the other side, so to speak. It'll be interesting to talk with all of our guests this evening. Let's welcome Sister Taylor Cummings. I think she's with us. Sister Taylor, are you there?
Sister? Yes, I am here. Hello.
Good. How are you?
Hi, I'm really well. I'm glad to be here.
And Sister Tierney Cherie, are you there with us?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
And I think Sister Lorray Muhammad is here somewhere. Yes, she's here. Sister Lorray, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm here. Peace, everyone.
Glad to have everybody with us this evening for this topic. I guess you heard myself and Brother Richard in the opening. We have a fourth guest that will be joining us a little bit later in the program, probably around 8 o'clock hour. Brother Obi Igbona Jr. will be with us, journalist, playwright, organizer, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper. Before we get started with our program this evening, I just want to get a little brief introduction from all of our guests. I guess we'll start first with Sister Taylor. She might be the youngest of all of us. I'm just assuming. I don't want to offend anybody, but she's a student at NC State. So let's hear from her. Sister Cummings, give us a little synopsis and introduction.
Hi, so my name is Taylor Cummings. I am a second-year master's student at NC State. I'm studying educational psychology. I have just applied to doctoral programs for the fall, so please send good vibes. But my research interests, they do include how socialization practices in schools affect Black students' psychological well-being, their self-determination, and their purpose, and also how Black students can actualize wellness and heal from the psychological trauma that's associated with their educational experiences. And I really do want to focus on the role that an Afrocentric perspective or worldview plays in that. And so I'm really excited to be here and connect with you all here at Time for an Awakening.
All right. Sister Tierney.
Yes, I'm Tierney Cherie. Basically, I host the YouTube channel show African Esquire TV, where I cover topics from around the African diaspora and in the continent of Africa, really from the perspective of being anti-colonialism, anti-neocolonialism, and anti-imperialism. Outside of that, I also organized a group called Recharge Colonialism, or an organization that seeks to raise awareness that Africans in the United States are being colonized by this government.
And I'm glad to have you with us this evening to give your perspective and insight. Sister Lorray Muhammad.
Yes, I'm here. Basically, my undergraduate degree is in international politics. I also double majored in sociology, and I have a master's in social work, and I'm a licensed MSW. So the conversation I know with the other two of us will be very interesting.
You know, go ahead, Richard.
In hearing, hopefully, y'all apologize and get with me when I step out of being an African man, in its place. But hearing the power of the women that we have present to shape this discussion is really powerful, especially. In the context of what we have to look at, right? Because we have to look at the people who are in power, who are of African descent, and who they represent. I mean, do they represent African people or represent the American empire? And then those of us who are claiming we are of not only African descent, but recognize that Africa is our center of gravity. And looking at what I'm hearing is we can address this from a geopolitical and a psychological aspect, and that's really important for us to be able to teeter that out, it seems to me.
When Brother Obi gets on, I want to give a detailed, and when I say detailed, I want to kind of go back a little bit further and give a historical perspective on this. But what I want to do right now, because I think I want to get all three of you sisters' perspective on it. If you look back at when the Peace Corps was started, I think it was started in 1960 or 61 by John Kennedy at that time and his brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver. They wanted some type of agency to develop peace and friendship in different countries that were supposed to be volatile. Once the Peace Corps was established, their main focus was the African continent. Now, at that time, as I recognize, I don't know of any African nation that was declaring war on the United States, but it was something going on the continent that was strangely familiar with things going on here. independence movements, awakening of the population to who they are and who we were, and the need for Pan-Africanism to move our people forward. That was dangerous to Western society, whether you're talking about Europe or the United States. So they had to develop a strategy to counteract this. One of the ways was the Peace Corps. And if we notice, some of the early black politicians, and even some to this current day, either was involved in the Peace Corps, had some type of associations with the Peace Corps, and definitely was involved politically. Because, and I want you ladies to clear me up on this. In order to be a diplomat, they were cultivating a lot of the diplomats from the Peace Corps. The diplomats have a relationship with the politicians, which entails the foreign policy. But what I want to do is dig into that Peace Corps for a little bit, because the new UN representative that's going in, is appointed by Biden, U.S. ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas Greenfield, that worked in the Obama administration, and now she's back in this position. She has a history that comes out of the Peace Corps. And I sent you ladies an interview that was done with her, and it was some interesting things said in that interview that our people really need to take a second look at, because I think what the popular media and especially Europeans, when they appoint blacks to these positions, they want to get blacks excited just to see a black face, just like they did with the Obamas when they went in. But it's something a little more sinister going on. I want to get your opinions on some of these things and the origins of things that happened on both the continent and here during the period of the 60s. Let's start with Sister Tierney, because I know that you have dealt with this on a lot of your podcasts. Talk about this from your perspective. What do you see in reference? Am I off base in saying that they cultivated a lot of these people that we see now out of the Peace Corps of the 60s?
Well, you know, I haven't studied the Peace Corps in particular, okay. But overall with the statement, I do agree that we're kind of giving these people who have black faces a way to kind of, I would say, to kind of distract us from what's actually we can see a person, we see them as a professional, we say, okay, they have these degrees, they've rose to prominence, and that's supposed to be the narrative that we focus on. We're not focused on what the person's doing. We're not focused on how their actions affect other African people. I think the media does a very good job of keeping those stories from us and keeping us from identifying the foreign policy of the United States with our own struggles. So it's definitely a way to pacify us and a way to, I would say, mask the U.S. imperialist agenda overseas.
Sister Ray, I hear you kind of give an affirmation here.
Amen. Amen over there.
I'm in full agreement. Let me know when you're ready.
Go ahead. And in fact, Sister Tierney, were you finished with your thought?
Yes, I'm finished.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, you can hear me?
Yes.
I'll make it sure. Okay. Basically, we have to remember, just because someone is black doesn't mean that their mindset is black. We've been here for so many centuries. So many of us have Stockholm Syndrome. And we want so bad to affiliate ourselves with the slave masters and their descendants that sometimes we're willing to do anything to accomplish that alliance or that friendship with them. It's kind of a sick relationship that we have with them because we want their friendship and they want to exploit us. So at every opportunity, they're willing to use us to exploit whatever their agenda is. One thing I noticed about that interview, and I sat and I watched it, was about 2 hours long. They never talked about the policies that America plans to implement with the African continent. they spoke basically about her employment history, and they also spoke about her upbringing. But the problem is, we need to know what the policy is. But really, we already know what the policy is. The policy is to maintain the Berlin Conference of 1884. And Europeans enrich themselves at the expense of Africans, and they want to continue to do so. And so they're willing to send the military in. They're willing to do whatever they have to do to maintain that relationship. And that relationship has been very beneficial to Europe. And a few years back, if you don't remember, many of those European countries said that they didn't have any money. So if you stole the first time to get your money, what are you going to do to get your money again? So now the problem is they see you coming because you did it before. So that's going to cause conflict in the region. Then we have the insertion of China, because China doesn't have enough food to feed their billion population. So China wants to get involved in the African situation because they have an agenda of they want somebody to grow food, but they want to be the new colonizer. Then Russia has another agenda. So now these three forces, America, the Europeans, well, really four, Russians, the Europeans are all the same. America, European, and Russians are all European, but they call themselves by these different names. And China are now going to come into a conflict because that's the richest nation in the world. And only for, and if you want to be the richest and first world power, you have to colonize Africa, because that's where all the natural resources are. That's the reason why they had to take out Muammar Gaddafi, and that's the reason why they had to take out Saddam Hussein. There are certain people that they had to kill because those people were going to interfere with what their agenda was, and so those people, unfortunately, as far as they were concerned, had to die. So they first have propaganda to convince the American people that they have to die. They always have some misinformation campaign rolling around. And then after that, they use the sanctions, and after that, they decide to send in the military. But most of the destabilization of the entire African continent can be traced to either Europe or America, because they're the only ones that have military ability to train anybody and to send in weapons to keep them at odds. But the only strategy that they use against us is our own disunity.
And before, Ellie, before you go to Sister Taylor, Sister Muhammad raised something about, and I think Sister Cherie raised something about the persons. And I just wanted to, in relationship to your point about Thomas Greenfield being a part of the, the Peace Corps, or at least, which is interesting, that history in itself, but and her placement of that time. But just in relationship to getting a handle on possibly her foreign policy thinking as this here representative, and as we continue the discussion, how our thinking should shape up. And I'm looking at this Volta article, and in it says Thomas Greenfield had a decade-long career in the U.S. Foreign Service, serving as the U.S. ambassador to Liberia, and later as the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State to African Affairs. During the second term of Obama's administration, at the start of Trump's administration, President Donald Trump's new leadership at the State Department tried to push her out, part of the larger purge of career Foreign Service officials. This is the part to get me. Thomas Greenfield retired in September 2017. She led the African practice at Albright Stonebridge Group, a firm headed by former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. And the reason why it's important to bring up about Madeleine Albright, because I think Susan Rice also is, and Condoleezza Rice is a, I'm going to call a surrogate of Albright.
Of Albright, yes.
And Madeleine Albright is a truly Anglophile as it relates to power politics. So I just wanted to, interject that for the Time for Awakening audience, to understand why we're talking about an African-centered perspective and who is being placed in these positions and who they'll actually serve and what we're looking out for.
Let's go to Sister Taylor. Sister Taylor, Sister Taylor, are you there? I think I might have lost her. Sister Taylor?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay. All right. Let me.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you. Let me. I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
course, we're talking about the interview that was done with Linda Thomas Greenfield. It was a couple of things there that I want your opinion on as a educational psychologist. She mentioned that she didn't come to terms with her treatment at the school she at LSU, I think, until she was an adult and went back to accept some award and made mention of it. Just briefly talk about that from the perspective of a woman that is has a certain level of responsibility and power in African foreign policy that hasn't come to terms with the treatment of Europeans, of not only her, but she talked about her parents. How does that work? Is that, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois talked about double consciousness. What's in play there? If you haven't come to terms with the treatment of yourself and your parents, but you're working for a government that touts American exceptionalism and American imperialism, how is that supposed to work?
Okay, so we are dealing with, right, socialization and conditioning and programming, right, to operate in the best interest of the institutions that we're a part of, like these establishments, right?
Okay.
And these establishments are here to uphold and reinforce white supremacy, right? So anything that we do within these institutions, which make up the system of racism, of white supremacy, right, we're only being allowed to do that and permitted to do that as long as it benefits the illusion. And so we really are dealing with the illusion of inclusion. And so I want to zoom out for a second, because we really started with this conversation of Pan-Africanism, right? And I heard some talk about geopolitical identity. And when we're dealing with Black Americans or Africans in general, sort of to know your ethnicity is a privilege, right? Just because of the slaughtering of our people, the displacement of our people, it's a privilege. And so I really like to think of our consciousness as our ethnicity. When we're dealing with melanin, we have to remember that melanin is carbon, right? It's carbon 12 specifically. And melanin was a word created by Europeans to cover up the fact that Black people have an abundance of an essential element of life that they do not have, right? So we're dealing with carbon copies, right? And so carbon, like this essential element of life that was created through the same triple alpha process that created our sun and our solar system, it allows us to be traced back to the creator, which is pure consciousness, right? So we have consciousness creating energy, creating elements, which are the fundamental building blocks for everything that we see in our physical world. And so they have to control our minds to get the results that they want, right? And our consciousness creates our reality. So if we are caught up in their world, their way of life, their way of being, we are creating their reality, which requires us to be at the bottom to uphold their illusion of white supremacy. And so this is why it is important to, as Shango and Bilishaka would say, to get our mind Black, right? We must take a step out of their illusionary world, right? We need to step into reality and remember that our consciousness is directly connected to the energy of the universe. And so there's no reason why we should not be able to materialize or create anything that we want here on this earth. But that cannot, you know, include replicating that which seeks to destroy us. And I really think that's what we see. And so Du Bois, he talks about this idea of double consciousness. And that's this idea that we see ourselves in two ways, right? We see ourselves through the eyes of our oppressor, but we also see ourselves through our own eyes. And I think we sort of pass this off as normal or just the way that it is. And I just really seem to find it incredibly dangerous and harmful. Like, I remember in undergrad, I went to, you know, predominantly white schools. I grew up in predominantly white areas. But then I transferred to ANT. I transferred to an HBCU. And this shook me to my core. You know, I was met with culturally affirming knowledge and truth about myself. And I remember a professor playing this TED Talk about double consciousness. And this woman, Black woman, she was essentially saying that we needed to embrace this double consciousness. And we sort of needed to see it as some sort of like superpower. And I just remember becoming angry, like absolutely not, because it is so hard to develop a sense of self when you are constantly warring with two identities. And so that's why I say, we sort of have to be gone with this double consciousness, and we've got to pick one. We've really got to pick one, because it impacts us in that way where we can't understand what's happening to our people at large.
We have to pick one. You hear that, Elliot? Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I want to interject something. And again, don't mind me. I'm as we are bouncing and having this conversation, I'm thinking and pulling together, you know, threads, you know, because as you say, all of us are saying we you know, when we're talking about creating a, you know, understanding the political reality and understanding the power, and I'm going to keep using these words, the power politics that we're part of and what we want to see. We have to recognize that others are, you know, as Elliot, as you always say, they're, you know, they're playing chess and we're playing checkers. And we have to make sure that we are in the game, or we are playing, if not their game, our game. And that's what I'm more concerned with when we're talking about an African-centered perspective. And I just wanted to interject this. I'm reading this, you know, going through this text that, you know, Elliot, our friend, brother, Dr. Earl Henderson, he has another book that I'm trying to get through, Afrocentrism and World Politics. And he's exploring Afrocentric political, analyzing Afrocentric political thought. And I came across this one quote he brought up in relationship to this analysis of a, you know, Afrocentric paradigm, right? Which is the second part of the towards a new paradigm. He uses a quote from Chiwenzi, and it says, "We have for too long been inculcated," and it goes to what Sister Taylor and everyone else has said, "inculcated with a mad awe of the West, and all that disarms us into a voluntary acceptance of whatever rubbish they tell us, even in circumstances where we would normally come bristly with skepticism, that we must rapidly develop a strong Afrocentric view of the world and of ourselves should be obvious. We must approach all problems and issues from the point of view of our own interests. We must hold suspect what the West tells us until we verify it for ourselves. Africa first ought to be our constant motto, not liberation first, not internationalism first, not Western approval first, not non-alignment first, but, and I'm adding this, Africa first." And I just thought that based off of what, you know, the intros that the sisters put, it kind of really reemphasizes that point when we're talking about looking at this African center, you know, the foreign policy and the people are being presented.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought, Sister Steele.
I was going to say that just reminded me of Dr. Marimba Ani, and she talks about cultural imperialism and how, you know, they impose their way of thinking on us. And when this happens, we cannot think in our best interest anymore. And like, we have to think about, like, at the individual level, what does that do to a person when you try to change them, right? It has very serious implications for your concept of self. And it's hard to do much of anything when you have a low self-esteem, right? And so that's why it's important for us to study who we are and where we came from and understand how we can take, you know, the best of our past to build a better future. But it also affects us, you know, like we've been talking about, as an entire cultural group. And that just shows, like, the implications for that and the necessity of that. As you said, Africa first.
You know, let me, because I want to go back around. I want to read a brief paragraph out of two of these articles. But first, I want to say this in reference to this training ground that they used in the 60s, the Peace Corps. If you notice in that clip, the interview, Linda Thomas Greenfield talked about when she was 12 years old, the Peace Corps came to her small rural town outside of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And it was Peace Corps volunteers, white and black, that came from the continent. If I'm saying that right, Richard.
Yes.
And was teaching them different words and things like that, developing interests in hopefully foreign policy and them to be Peace Corps volunteers. Now, she was 12 years old, so they were cultivating this. And they used a strategy. I could see clearly that they used a strategy at that time to implement this in rural small towns, because I don't recall them coming to any major cities recruiting for the Peace Corps in inner city neighborhoods. Richard, do you remember it when you were a young boy back in the 60s?
No, I didn't. I'm not aware of it. I'll say it that way.
Yeah, well, we can see if you look at some of the other quote-unquote black, and I'll use that term loosely, luminaries of that period that participated in the Peace Corps, a lot of them was from small rural southern areas. So we can see a strategy here by Europeans to go to these small towns and try to cultivate minds that they could use. And she was 12 at the time. So evidently she was one of the minds that they eventually end up using. But let me read this, and I'm going to go to Sister Tierney to get her opinion on this. This from a published report from a person that became an official in the Peace Corps. And it's entitled Peace Corps and American Interests in Africa. It says, and this article was from 2011. It says, this marks the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Peace Corps. John F. Kennedy and his brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver. President Kennedy founded the Peace Corps just a moment that most sub-Saharan states were moving towards independence. He also tapped into American idealism that flourished in the 60s, which included a dramatic process towards racial and gender equality in the United States. One concrete example of the Peace Corps' influence on Africa is former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, establishment of American University of Nigeria, the AUN, in Yola. The AUN is a secular university and based on American education models, which Abubakar was introduced to by Peace Corps volunteers working in his village when he was a boy. The National Peace Corps Association, a private nonprofit supporting returning Peace Corps volunteers, honored the former vice president for his contribution this past weekend. Present, there are more Peace Corps alumni from the 60s. Many of them talk about how serving in a Peace Corps volunteer in Africa was their first introduction to a part of the world largely unknown in the United States. Unlike the UK, France, Germany, and Italy, the U.S. had never had any significant role and presence in Africa. Now, it mentioned here in this particular article that this person that at the time was a vice president in Nigeria had established a university in Nigeria based on the educational model that he received when UN Peace Corps volunteers came to his village in Africa when he was a boy. Now, keep that in mind. Let me read this brief paragraph from a speech that Condoleezza Rice gave to the Peace Corps Worldwide Directors Conference in 2008. It says, the State Department has been known to tap your vast intellectual resources and to use those skills as people come back to build careers in foreign policy. There, I am told, 22 of you have served under U.S. ambassadors, and that's quite a record. I want to tell you that this is really one of the great American success stories. When John F. Kennedy, some four decades ago, challenged America through a speech to students at the University of Michigan to serve their country in a cause of peace by living and working in developing countries, he did something very special. John Kennedy's vision of the Peace Corps, men and women who have served in 139 countries and are really involved at the grassroots level, living in the community and making a difference one person at a time. I think of them as the right people at the right time. So we see here, and Sister Tierney, weigh in on this. We see here from these two articles that the mindset that was developing among young blacks on both sides of the Atlantic by these white Peace Corps volunteers was to to develop a mindset among blacks on both sides of the continent to be surrogates for American policy. What do you see in the two things I just read, the quote by the Peace Corps volunteer and the statement by Condoleezza Rice in 2008? How do you see that in reference to what we're up against and what they've been doing all along to develop these people in foreign policy positions that'll control what's going on blacks here in the States and blacks on the continent?
What I see in the quotes that you just mentioned is the persistent U.S. foreign policy that is indoctrination. Africans, we have to believe that this system is the right standing system, that our own systems, there's no validity in them. Because from there, can essentially indoctrinate more Africans. It's the whole setup of colonial education. Whenever the colonists had an education system in place, the purpose of that was to ensure that the colonized believed that the European colonizer was the one who was upright, was the one who was civilizing them. And to me, that's the same exact thing. And that's the mentality, I think, even in Condoleezza Rice or in what you hear in a lot of U.S. Foreign officials, mm-hmm. that we're bringing to the right way. We're bringing you into the way that things should be done. All of this, of course, we know is to ensure that we the African masses conform to U.S. interests. The interests are always for the U.S. to have control in Africa, to have control over the resources, to have control over the land. But of course, if you believe in the system, if you believe in the white supremacist capitalist system, if you believe that that's the true system that should be in place, then you won't challenge the system. So to me, when I hear those types of things, it just reminds me that the purpose and the operation of indoctrination is to really kill any fight, you know, and that's what you see internationally. Not a lot of people, you look at people in places of prominence, are willing to challenge policies, even when we can see the results that have caused murders and death and destruction of African people internationally. But that's because a lot of our fight has been killed because we have been bought into the lie that this is the only way to do things and this is the best way to do things, and that things that are authentically African are essentially backwards.
Richard.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, Sister Sheree. And, you know, I'm looking at when we're talking about how this is operationalized, you know, Elliot, you're bringing up about the Peace Corps and bringing up the State Department, you know. So politically in the last 4 years, they're telling us, but it's been, I'd say, but definitely in the last 4 years, the State Department has been, quote unquote, gutted, right? And I'm going to use the term retooled. What I find is interesting, I'm just throwing this out there. Who becomes the chairperson for the Foreign Policy Committee in Congress, right? Who becomes the chairperson? Another black person, Gregory W. Meeks. He's now going to be the chairperson for that Foreign Policy Committee. And him and Karen Bass, who's been there, Karen Bass has been there all along. But this quote in his press release is interesting as he becomes chair of what he says is concerning and what he's going to be pushing forward. This will not be a return to normal. This will not be a return to normal, but a leap towards a new way of doing business. We will broaden our scope and outreach to parts of the world we haven't historically outlooked. We will return as partners to our European allies, but we will also need to build new multilateral relationships in the Western Hemisphere and Africa. We can only address the systemic challenges posed by Moscow and Beijing with the help of like-minded friends. And I take it the like-minded friends goes back to those people who are being cultivated, you know, and has been cultivated, especially. And the reason I'm want us to be to look at who Obama, you know, have been cultivating that are now going to be filling the State Department or State Department related positions that we probably don't even see. We don't know. We don't even know about. And this is after last year, you had the year return for Africa, right? You know, so everybody's, you know, looking at that. But on the ground, on the continent, there are certain things that is disturbing in relationship to the amount of dissatisfaction amongst the African, the youth in the African populace, Senegal, Uganda, Nigeria, and Congo, Ethiopia. And we who are here are sitting in the position. So I don't want, you know, go any further, but I thought that it's just interesting that look who becomes the another tool. So you got a UN ambassador, you know, of African descent who is sitting at the UN. And now you have in the Congress, you had the head of the Foreign Affairs Committee who will be pushing through things who is of African descent. I don't know. I know it ain't no coincidence, but and he's talking about and they're talking about Africa being the focus while we're also have been saying Africa has always been our focus as a unified continental nation state.
You know, Richard, you brought up Meeks that's going into this chair, House Foreign Affairs Committee. But has he approached his constituents or black people in general, because he's in the black, he's in the CBC, about his position on foreign policy, his position on foreign affairs? Has he talked about this? What is it? Do black people know it?
I don't think so. What do you say, Sister Muhammad, as far as, you know, with this whole thing of now we're putting some skeletons to who in blackface is not having an African consciousness, as Sister Teller brought up, but who in blackface is taking these positions in relationship to dealing with providing the going towards the African continent and the strategic outlook they have?
We have to remember that the policy has already been written 50 years, 75 years in advance. That's why they're playing chess and we're playing checkers. So they already know what the policy is going to be. The only thing that they've decided is who is going to implement their policy. And we have to recognize that black people can implement white supremacy. We are in the mindset that white supremacy is something that cannot be implemented by somebody who's not white. But in fact, if you're stepping into a government role as an elected official, that's exactly what you're doing. You're implementing whatever rules that they already have written out for you. You're an employee. You do what the boss tells you to do. You don't really have any decision-making on the policy. And they're deciding what you're going to do, and you just either march in line and do what they ask you to do, or you cannot work there. The reason why they're cultivating them at such a young age is because they want to indoctrinate them fully with white supremacy so that they'll automatically oppress black people, because white supremacy is black oppression. So if I have the idea in my mind that white people are better, everything that white people say is what I'm supposed to do that, because they're the culture that's running things and I don't question it, then I'm going to do whatever they say. That's why you have so many situations in the continent where you have black people fighting other black people. One of the things that they did in the Berlin Conference when they drew borders, they always made sure that conflicting groups were inside within those borders. And they manipulate through the strategy of divide and conquer to have us constantly fighting one another. But the policy is already established. All these people can possibly do is step into the role that they're given and go in and do whatever they ask them to do. And I guess because you're black, they will assume somewhat until they find out different that you don't necessarily have their best interest at heart. The problem that they're going to have on the continent also is that the youth have a different mindset than some of these people who've been there forever. they're not thinking about, because they haven't gone to the Sorbonne. They haven't gone to these schools in Europe to learn white supremacy. They're on the ground. They realize that things are, they're being oppressed. They don't like what's going on in the continent. They want things to change. And that's really the group that's going to do the changing. Because as long as you buy into white supremacy, you can't help anybody. You can't even help yourself, because you're so sick in your head about how you're viewing yourself. How are you going to help your people when you already see yourself as less than? You're going to do whatever master tells you to do, because on some level you think that master's right.
What we're going to do, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We got some callers on the line that might want to get involved, and you can do that by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. You know, before we go off and take a break, let me go back to Sister Taylor. Sister Taylor, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Sister, before I let you go, because I know you want to get on the road, and I'm keeping
you. She's traveling now? Oh, my goodness.
Sister Taylor, as a clinical psychologist, I want your perspective on this, because... or educational psychologists, because when our people were, when we came out of chattel enslavement, when we transitioned out of chattel enslavement and fought for our freedom, it was one thing that was missing, because we started towns, we started businesses, we were working with one another because we were basically forced to, and we were moving our people forward. But one component that we didn't have in that was a mental reclamation. Our people coming out of that state of enslavement for hundreds of years was obviously damaged. We had freedom fighters that was in the mix. We had people that were in the mix that really didn't have, that was satisfied with being on a plantation. We had people in the mix that were straight out wanted meritorious manumission. They couldn't wait to, I'll use the term rat on other sisters or brothers. We had a whole mishmash of mentalities that were thrown together after our people left those plantations. And we never really received any mental help. Talk about it from the perspective now as a solution to our problems moving forward from your perspective. Give us that before you leave us.
So I'm going to start with a quote from one of my favorite, it's one of my favorite quotes. It's not my favorite movie, but it was Joshua Abba, and he's in the Beyonce's Black is King. And what he says is, when it's all said and done, I don't even know my own native tongue. And if I can't speak myself, I can't think myself. And if I can't think myself, I can't be myself. And if I can't be myself, I will never know me. So Uncle Sam, tell me this, if I will never know me, how can you? And I think it really does speak to that, because it's a matter of, we're looking at a group of people who have never had our best interests at heart to provide us with opportunity and freedom or liberation, as some might even call it, to get us out of our situation. And because we're operating in their system and their reality, we are now dependent on them, and we're doing things that are unnatural to us. And so we've really got to take a good, hard look at what we're doing and why we are doing it, and come to the understanding that no one is going to get us out of the situation but us. And we have so many experts and talent in our community, and we really have to focus our attention and our energy towards our own, and really look at, you know, this idea of Sankofa, like going to our past and looking at where we've come from and studying our systems. And really looking at what were they doing, and taking the best of those systems and bringing them to the future so that we can build better systems and a better future for ourselves and for all those to come after us. And I want to say that it was Ms. Cherie who was talking about education and challenging, oppressive education, just challenging oppression in general. And we know that, you know, every man has two educations, the one that is given to him and the one that he teaches himself. And what we are taught, you know, Woodson mentions this in The Miseducation of the Negro, what we are taught seldom nourishes the mind like that we teach ourselves. And so I find myself teaching myself a lot of things because what is presented to me just it don't sit well with my spirit. And so in order to challenge the oppressive education that has been given to me, I have to find the Asa Hilliards of the world, the Dr. Wade Nobles, the Dr. Marimbaanis, the Dr. Kanbans, the Asantes of the world, and so many others to name, to give me the language, the theories, and the strength to rewrite the Black experience. And so I'm very early in my scholarly journey, but I think it really has to do with us redefining and giving new language or old language, right? But being able to take hold of our own phenomena so that we can move forward in a way that is not bound by white supremacy. And I just think Black people are very afraid of what that might look like because they don't know anything outside of that. And so I think it really starts with that, being able to define our own reality.
Richard, Sister Taylor said our people are afraid.
I try not to generalize, but I'm afraid. I'm afraid, that when we step out, it doesn't matter the numbers, right? Our Maroon experience showed that, we can win. We can have that consciousness of victory and it don't have the large one, but that, a lot that will be presented in front of us, like saying that we can be able to go to the continent and build up the tourist industry, right? And we can go to, Amina or Gory Allen and have that African experience, and that we're really re-emphasizing our African beingness. But in reality, those who are helping those state actors to do that are only doing that because it's service. And if we don't have, as Sister Taylor says, if we don't have a clear understanding of who these actors are, because now, as Sister Muhammad said, there'll be, coming, with Black face and very, we'll be thinking, oh, they're looking out for, we're all in this together, when that is not the case. So I agree with all wholeheartedly.
Sister Taylor, I want to thank you for being part of this conversation, and I'm going to tap into your understanding and maybe later programs, because we need a young person's perspective on some of the things going on and the challenges that we face.
I thank you so much for having me, and I'm so happy to have been able to listen. Well, I'm still saying, but listen and learn from all of you here tonight.
Talk to you soon. Thanks for being with us. We're going to take a brief break. I want folks to hold on. Sister Lorraine and Miss Tierney, hold on after the break. And we'll probably have Brother Obi Agbona Jr. join us after the break. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You can get involved, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215 215- 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you've called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP of the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the Slave Theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we're black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House, you can even put him in his, he's going to still be a Tom. You can put them anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Encourage, let me just say this before our time winds up, and that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lauren Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:18 here in the city of Philadelphia, and you're in the Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. And the with our guest this evening, researcher and author of the book Black Integration, A Failed Social Experiment. Sister Lorraine Muhammad is with us, African Esquire TV host, Sister Tierney Cherie, organizer, journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper. Brother Obey Egbona will be joining us. And she's left because she had an engagement, but I guess she's still listening. NC State educational psychology major, Sister Taylor Cummings, was with us earlier in the program. The topic.
Hey,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, no. The topic, an African-centered perspective. Look at U.S.-African foreign policy. Go ahead before I bring the guests back on, Richard. What'd you say?
No, I wanted to ask Sister Cherise something. I heard something on one of our podcasts, and I think it ties to this, and hopefully she's be able to, because we're now when we're talking about this, we're talking about the continuation of global America's global colonization project, right? Going back to Liberia. But it was something that she reported on that fits something, I believe fits something else. And I just wanted, before I asked her, and hopefully I won't be embarrassed by asking the wrong thing, but I just noticed that there is a, and I wanted to see if you knew, there's a partnership occurring with Ghana around the Du Bois Center. Primarily, a lot of the people who are involved in this partnership comes out of Harvard, and it's the W.E.B. Du Bois Foundation, which is headquartered in New York, and they have a memorandum of understanding to be able to with the Ghanaian government, or at least the tourist industry, to redo or upbring the W.E.B. Du Bois Center. Where Dr. Du Bois and his wife Shirley are buried, also, and it's, you know, it's still, for me, I'm just becoming aware of it. It's still being fleshed out. But the reason I want to bring this up and how it relates to how culture can be a part of the foreign policy toolkit in relationship to being able to get acceptance, with this here. A particular group of African people who are now being a part of the foreign policy or State Department and even the political machinery and perpetuating America's foreign policy interests on the continent. We know that AFCOM is already there. The military aspect of America's interests is already all the way throughout the continent. So what I wanted to ask Sister Cherie, if she could be able to, inform to make my point, and how this not just affects us, but is affecting the decisions that are being made by African heads of state. And Sister Cherie, you had mentioned about in Ghana, hopefully that's right, there is, I don't know if it's the done deal, but the question of putting out gold mines or selling gold mines or placing them on to where they would be sold. And this is being done by leadership within the Ghanaian government. Am I characterizing that information that you put out correctly?
Yes. I talked about an article, a couple articles that have come out as Ghana is about to have an election soon. Some news has come out about the current president, some dealings he's had selling off the future gold royalties of the country.
Why I think that that's so important in relationship to this thrust for the continent, that we have to be very conscious, because that may entail the financial arm of the government. And another example is, that there's a company out of North Carolina that's operating out of Rwanda that have drones that are being that could be able to send medical supplies using drones to from one destination to the other. And here's, if I'm understanding this right, Elliot, and to the Time for Waking audience, here we have an American company that created and it's three people that's involved in it, and all of them are
Anglo-Americans or Euro-Americans or whites, they own this here Zipline company, and they are now operating within Rwanda, and they last year created an agreement with Ghana to be able to have these drones that will fly through in their space. This company's, you know, so here is an American interest, company interest. We're not talking about just raw materials anymore, right? We're talking about the technological aspect, and they're going to be developing a technological employment infrastructure amongst Ghanaians. And the question is, how do we, as, you know, who are here, who are Pan-African, how do we look at this? Because there's more and more companies of another generation takes foothold on the continent. What does that mean in relationship to America as a nation state taking foothold? So here you have, as Sister Cherie said, the thing about the gold, and then you got this here drones. I just think that this just says that we have to be more vigilant about the political representatives that are pushing these foreign policy initiatives on the continent. Where are they coming from? And primarily, like, who is supposed to benefit? Because when we talk about it from our worldview, it's supposed, the continent is supposed to be able to benefit African people and not, and all over, not benefit European countries as colonization has done and neo-colonialism has done, but for African people. We want to be clear of what our worldview is about and what our strategic objective is about, not just watching this thing unfold and unfold in front of our eyes.
Yeah, if I could comment on that, I think that the common issue is that we in the diaspora have to be very clear on what it is that we want as far as when we're talking about African liberation, because mm-hmm. the things that you just discussed, those are things that can be very much disguised as things like development. And that's one thing we constantly hear from both people in the diaspora and on the continent is development. But we're not thinking about the fact that that development is coming at the cost of our autonomy, of the cost of self-determination. We essentially are more focused on the image of being like the West rather than having control over our own politics. And so that's, I think, a common theme in a lot of the different industries that you see going into Africa. I think it's a common theme among a lot of the figures, public figures that are coming out. I did another video, which you reminded me of when I was, you were discussing the Du Bois Center, about how they're building a Wakanda in like Cape Coast in Ghana and or something like a Wakanda without, of course, the political autonomy, but something like that, you know, basically for, in my opinion, when you look at the details, it seems more like a tourist attraction. And a lot of people were celebrating that because, you know, we get excited because of imagery and symbolism and, you know, but we're not thinking about how does that actualize into the people actually having a real material benefit from these projects. More so than not, it's not going to. more so than not, we're going to continue to see that the people have no control over their resources. Their politicians don't serve their interests. Their politicians are puppets that are serving Western interests. And so I think just, again, as a diaspora, we have to be very specific when we're talking about African liberation. Do we want the image of liberation, or do we want true freedom for our people?
Mm. Wow. You know, we're going to bring Brother Obi Egbona Jr. into this conversation. I think he'll add an historic perspective to what we're talking about from his personal experience as a foreign journalist and through his experiences of his father in being a young man growing up in the presence of some of our historic greats, hearing conversations, seeing personal experiences and having personal knowledge. I want to bring him into this conversation because I know he can add a wealth of knowledge to it. Welcome to the program, journalist, playwright, organizer, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald. That's Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Egbona Jr. Brother Obi.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How are you, sir?
Hey, what's up, brother?
Okay. Hey, what's up? All those adjectives and labels, I'm just your brother.
Well, wait a minute. It's true. I'm not saying nothing that ain't true now. I'm not saying nothing that ain't true.
And I don't think I can add too much after listening to the fire of these folks. I'm listening to these sisters. Yeah, greetings to everybody on the panel. So where are we going with this?
Well, listen, because I know you can add a historical perspective to this. And I started from the 60s because it was things going on on the mainland here, Black Power movement and what they consider the Civil Rights movement, and was things going on the continent at the same time. So America comes up with a strategy where they develop the Peace Corps and train blacks here, a lot of them in small urban small southern rural areas to be emissaries on the continent, right. And they were also training young black folks on the continent for similar duties. Talk about it from your perspective of somebody that have been there, that have seen this in working fashion. Am I off pace? Let our listening audience know.
You're not off base, but I'm glad you said the 60s because it's a privilege every time we get a chance to use the 60s to reaffirm the point that we have to stop treating the 1960s like Christians treat the Garden of Eden. Let's bring it up current, though, and then go all the way back. Anytime we have this conversation about the diplomatic arms and vehicles of U.S., European Union imperialism, we have to go back to Barack Obama's inauguration in 2008. And in the cold, he said something very hot. He said that the might of our military must be matched by the strength of our diplomacy. And what that means in a nutshell is, while our preference is to assassinate leaders who we can intimidate, while our preference is to bomb nations like the Ku Klux Klan burnt crosses on our yards in their heyday, if we have to resort to diplomatic means to impose our will, to promote the continual culture of genocide, we have no problem doing that. So, but if we're going to talk about the African imprint on this process, the African imprint on this methodology, you got to go back to Ralph Bunche. Because between 1941 and 1943, Ralph Bunche worked in the Office of Strategic Services, which was the Wartime Intelligence Service, as a senior social analyst on colonial affairs. And then in 1943, after that, he was transferred from the OSS to the State Department. Then the next person, and of course, you know Bunch's relationship to Harry Truman, Africans who voted for Truman, who had the opportunity to vote, you know Truman for putting the finishing touches on the Zionist State of Israel, bringing the CIA into existence and desegregating the military. So you have to look at that. Then another person you would look at in this paradigm is Karl Rowan. Many people, younger people on here may remember or have read about Karl Rowan's article in the 1990s after Spike Lee's Cash In on Malcolm X project. He said Malcolm was no hero of his at any point. But Karl Rowan starts off as a journalist. And then he eventually, in 1961, he becomes the Assistant Secretary of State to Kennedy. And then his assignment is he's a special delegate to the UN at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. They send him to Finland for a year. Then he becomes, in 1964, the very first director of the United States Information Agency, appointed by Lyndon Johnson. And basically, throughout the Vietnam War, he was sitting in Lyndon Johnson's lap, and he's the first U.S.-born African to hold a seat on the National Security Council. Okay, so then let's go to 1966, and we take a look at February 24th, 1966, while Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad are having a meeting of the minds in Chicago. Osage for Dr. Kwame Nkrumah is overthrown en route to Vietnam to present a peace plan to end the Vietnam War. And his classmate at Lincoln University, Franklin Williams, is the U.S. ambassador to Ghana. And he says, and all the way to the end of his life, he swore he had nothing to do with the planning of the coup. He didn't even know there was planning of the coup, which tells you a lot about what they think about Africans in this position. Even though they toilet train them, even though they breastfeed them, even though they indoctrinate them to all hell, they still don't trust them completely. So to look at how that process, you understand the thought process behind Constance Barry Newman, who serves as the Assistant Secretary for African Affairs under Bush. Or if you want to go into the difference, there are some of our people in our community, because of the never-ending lovers' quarrel between Democrats and Republicans, you got some Africans who will argue you down that Susan Rice and Condoleezza Rice are different. But both of them are products of Madeleine Albright. And the only difference between them is complexion and hairdo and party affiliation, but they are both committed to U.S. imperialism's efforts. As we say, then when you take a look at this shift from military repression to diplomatic repression, another major player in this process is Colin Powell. Colin Powell goes from fighting two tours in Vietnam. He enjoyed that so much. The tail end of the Korean War, the assassination of Maurice Bishop, his prints all over it, the bombing of Libya in 1986, killing the two-year-old daughter of Muammar Gaddafi, his prints all over that. He becomes a born-again diplomat. And in his diplomatic capacity, he takes off his fatigues and he puts on a suit and he imposes sanctions on Zimbabwe. So, and because he starts to vote Democrat, he is absolved of all of his crimes against humanity by African people. And then you look at this in terms of resources. People were talking about Ghana. Those of us in the United States, yes, Akufo Addo, Ghana's current president, he is the grandnephew of J.B. Dankwa, who was the leader of the United Gold Coast Convention, which was the first vehicle to fight against colonialism in Ghana, but was not committed to the revolutionary path. And when Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah shows up and pushes revolution, they create the Convention People's Party. The masses abandon the United Gold Coast Convention because it was not a revolutionary vehicle. And Dankwa declares himself an enemy of Nkrumah for life. His uncle, Pa Willie, as they used to call him, they created the first opposition party to Nkrumah in Ghana. And they work with the British and the United States to bring about the overthrow of Nkrumah. So, but the thing about this is when you look at people in these capacities, it is in conjunction with what our young people what is being imposed on them to propagate at this historical moment. On the individual level, this represents Black excellence because these are accomplished individuals with an academic pedigree who on an individual basis, you can convince some of our people they should strive to follow their direction, follow their example. In the context of generational wealth, you have on the continent, the main focus that the neocolonialist governments are pushing is a document called Agenda 2063. And at the same time, the document that's being pushed on us in this country that get focused on Africa is something called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. And the woman who wrote that was the first person to become a trade officer in the diplomatic corps appointed by the Clinton administration named Rosa Whitaker. And they call her the mother of AGOA. And she, and through her, the United States Department of Commerce now has something called the U.S.-Africa Business Exchange. And what they're doing in Ghana is to engineer the third phase of neocolonialism. We've defeated military neocolonialism in Africa. We have neutralized civilian neocolonialism, and now you have a revolutionary masquerade, which is neocolonialist. Also, there's a strategic dimension to this. You can look at the Caribbean. We were forewarned about this by Maurice Bishop in 1979. He said that he did a speech called A New Tourism, and he talked about how neocolonialism would be promoted using the vehicle of tourism, where your tourist enclaves on a cultural level would increase decadent behavior. He included homosexuality, ironically, but he talked about you would see blue-collar crime increase. You would see these things. And he said, and the worst thing of all, it would do a number on your efforts to make your people patriotic. because if all the resources are going towards maintaining a tourist enclave, and a few miles away from your tourist enclave, people are starving. People don't have health care. People don't have adequate living. People don't have clean drinking water, which are supposed to be the tenets of what are called sustainable development goals by progressive liberals at this particular point. So these are the things that we have to look at very carefully. And in terms of how we organize, we just continue to organize. And when we do this, understand something. In the same way that we on the far left on the spectrum, some would say we're in retreat. Some would say that we're strategically and tactically regrouping. The right is regrouping as well. So in the same way, and the thing about it is Ralph Bunche is an intelligence officer. Karl Rowan is a former military officer. Charles Rangel, who created a project called the Bunche Center at Howard University 20 years ago. And the purpose of the Bunche Center, he got millions of dollars from private corporations. The argument is this, that there's still disparity in the public policy sector. So you're going to see, so the purpose of this, it's calling for more Susan Rices, more Condoleezza Rices, more Johnny Carsons, more of these people. And in terms of the woman that the latest one, Linda Thomas Greenfield, that's her name. She's a product of Madeleine Albright as well. And so when you look at Madeleine Albright's influence, her father trained Condoleezza Rice. She made Condoleezza Rice give up a career as an aspiring concert pianist to become a diplomat. And then in the case of Susan Rice, she's a product of that. So when you look at the fact that within a 15-year period, three sisters are products of Madeleine Albright's training, I'm expecting the next time I go to the grocery store to see a brown rice recipe for Madeleine Albright. Right next to Bobby Seale's barbecue cookbook. You know what I mean?
So
So if we're really going to get into this, we just have to organize. And when the young people a few years ago at Howard, they were protesting in front of the administration building, and for 48 hours they changed the name of the Mordecai Wyatt Johnson building to the Kwame Ture building. And I got a chance to meet some of them. And I said, what made Kwame Ture want to come to Howard is that the students of Howard were protesting against the persecution of Paul Robeson. And the Office of American Affairs at that time? The Washington office. And this was one of the main things. So I said, at what point are Howard students going to protest about the Bunche building? And this is in conjunction with another pet project that President Obama launched called the Young African Leadership Institute. And this is a project to train African students born on the continent to ensure that they ideologically direct them and help them navigate through life. What does that mean? It means, and it's a complete reverse of Nnamdi Azikiwe, who led the anti-colonial movement in Nigeria, who came to Lincoln University, encouraged Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah to come to Lincoln University. Eduardo Mondlane, the founder of FRELIMO, which liberated Mozambique in an armed struggle, he went to Oberlin College and was teaching when was about to teach at Syracuse University before he joined the revolution. So they said, we're going to break this cycle. Or you look at how Fela Kuti started off as a music student in Nigeria, in London, before he became who he became. Maurice Bishop was at Gray's Inn in London studying law before he became who he became. Walter Rodney was in London pursuing his academic studies before he became who he became. So they said, we're going to reverse this trend. And so the thing is, no more time. Emil Carr Cabral was one of the only 14 college graduates in Guinea-Bissau during his time and went to Portugal for school. You know what he ended up going back to Guinea-Bissau and doing. So as we're doing what we're supposed to do, let's not be naive. Our enemies are doing what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to regroup. They're supposed to develop more sophisticated strategies to hold on to what they control. And we're supposed to be revitalizing new strategies so we can reclaim what we haven't had in the longest, and haven't had it in so long that we have forgotten that it belongs to us in the first place.
Wow. Well, listen, you laid it out. Sister Lorraine, jump in here. You heard Brother Obi Gwona said that that's what we're supposed to be doing. Our concentration should be on developing new strategies to fight in this battle.
What are the strategies we can use to stop letting our children go to the military to fight on ground, on continent, where we're supposed to be living? They kidnapped us and they brought us here. Why are we sending our children to Africa to fight for the colonizer? That's one of the strategies. We must stop our children from going to the military. They should have an exemption just based on the fact that you would leave your oppressor to go fight for your oppressor in another country. That sounds like diminished capacity. All black men should be exempt from the military just based on the idea that they should not be over there fighting for their oppressor. That is a serious concern, because if they don't have a military to implement colonialism, how are they going to hold on to what they've stolen? They don't have enough people on their own to do it. And it seems as though COVID-19 is going to destroy the Europeans, because they're dying very quickly there. And so who's going to be over there in Africa fighting these wars besides us? That's one of the biggest things we need to look at. Why are our children dying in Niger? Why are we trying to help, Macron hold on to Central African Republic? Why are we over there fighting the wars of colonialism and we ourselves are colonized here? So that's, to me, is a strategy, because if they don't have a military, how are you going to fight to save what you want to keep or to steal what you want to maintain? So unity and stop letting our males and our female children go into war. That's what I was thinking about when he was talking.
And she's exactly right, because that's why in our vehicle we have the Mass Emphasis Positive Action and Creativity Youth Brigade, the children came up with a documentary called Don't Play These Roles, saying that our actors and actresses should not play military officers, intelligence officers, or police officers anymore. Because whenever we protest against them, they focus on recruitment. Ever since the George Floyd situation, the police departments in the United States of America have spent millions of dollars on recruitment strategies in our community. That's how they're planning to rebound. But my thing was, our people, in the same way that the Ku Klux Klan members and White Citizens Council members took off their hoods and put on police uniforms, military officers are taking off their fatigues and they get into foreign services and they get into the diplomatic corps. So while it is a given that, and I love what the sister had to say, because I was with my students a couple of weeks ago and I asked them a question. We always do what Du Bois talked about, a sociological, just a quick experiment. And I asked them, I said, these are young people between 9 years old and 18 that I have. I'm not smart enough to teach at the university level. So I asked the question, when you think of Tuskegee, what's the first thing that comes to mind? They all said the Tuskegee Airmen. And I said, in one generation, there have been about 7 movies about the Tuskegee Airmen, to the point that they're going to become the initial point of reference about Tuskegee and not Booker T. Washington. Because as much as people criticize Booker T. Washington in hindsight, the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey became who he was because he wrote Booker T. Washington's autobiography. So yes, they use every vehicle at their disposal to recruit us to serve their interests at every level. And what it's going to mean is, in terms of Africa, some of us, we did a play last year called Maintaining Poverty While in Dignity. And the backdrop was about 2 millionaires that went back to Ghana to get married. And their maids, their gardeners, their drivers were underground in Kruma Circle. They were planning a revolution against the neo-colonialist government in Ghana. So they only shared their plans with them at the end. And they're going to march on the United States Embassy. That's their first action. And many people don't remember. People know now that Du Bois died the night before the March on Washington. But the very next day, Maya Angelou, Julian Mayfield, Tom Feelings, my beautiful elder sister friend who's still with us, y'all got to interview her, Elliot, I'm going to set it up, Alice Windham, they marched on the U.S. Embassy in conjunction with the March on Washington. Their demands were no U.S. intervention in Cuba, no U.S. intervention in Vietnam, and they wanted the freedom of Mae Mallory, who was the sister
who, along with John Henry Clark, the academician, and Julian Mayfield, ran guns from Harlem to Monroe to help Robert Williams arm our people to protect them in Monroe, North Carolina. She was still in prison at that point. So those were their demands, but they marched from the U.S. Embassy. So I tell these Africans in Ghana now, when Africans in Ghana erupt, are you going to go into the streets with them, or are you going to run towards the U.S. Embassy faster than Usain Bolt and ask them to bring you home? And your definition of home is the United States. The lines are drawn. We're going to do what we need to do. Let them do what they need to do. And let's see who wins. It's as simple as that.
It's interesting.
It's as simple as that.
The Tuskegee, because I see that it's a senator, Chris Cohn, who pushed through a flight act, which is pushing for the HBCUs to train through the ROTC to train pilots, which I thought was just interesting, you know, and it falls in that the propaganda machine of pushing, you know, Tuskegee airmen would be a way, just like you said, about to be able to energize young people to want to go in that direction.
No, it's you got that with the Tuskegee airmen. Colin Powell used his tenure on the board of trustees at Howard University to put ROTCs back on every HBCU in this country. Him and Earl Graves of Black Enterprises worked in conjunction with that. Right around that same period, a former member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, believe it or not, the very first organization to come out against the Vietnam War, Frank Smith, former city councilman, he's the director of the African American Civil War Museum in D.C. And that is also, and when they had their first parade, you really want to laugh? Guess what happened? The Africans, of course, were dressed up like those who fought with the North, right? Some Africans came dressed up in the uniforms of those who fought in the South and said, we need, our ancestors need to be honored too. And they held hands and marched down the street. I'm telling you some real stuff. And so I'm just saying that, but Howard University in particular, their African Studies Department was put together by the Pentagon. At one point in the early 1980s, now my father told me this, you know who was teaching Southern African history at Howard in the early 80s? A man who was a member of RENAMO. RENAMO was the CIA vehicle that was created to fight against Samora Machel and Free Limo. They had him teaching young people about the history of Southern Africa. What you think his syllabus looked like? What you think his curriculum looked like? So this is something that then a friend of mine, John Trimble, took like 15 students to Cuba about 20 years ago. The Ralph Bunch Center found the names of these students, had a private meeting with them, and gave them a list of Afro-Cubans, as they called them, to meet with while they were in Cuba. In 1994, Howard University was the only school picked to go and observe the elections in what's called South Africa when Mandela and de Klerk shared power. And they had a camera crew that went. The TV department went. It was a project with a camera crew. Some of the people who went in the delegation, they told me they had them covering Inkatha rallies. 70% of the time they were there. These are the type of things that go on a daily basis. We just don't know. And every summer, young people come from all over the country, from other HBCUs, and they go for training in the Bunch Center. Personal experience I had real quickly, in 2006, with the Howard University chapter of the American Medical Students Association, they decided on World AIDS Day to have a program to talk about Cuba's role in trying to eradicate AIDS in Africa. And now there are two medical buildings on Howard's campus. Now this is the organization. All of a sudden, all the rooms were booked up. And the only room that was available was the main room at the Bunch Center up the street. So basically, they were recording that meeting. So these are the type of things that go on. And if we're focusing on these things, what we need to do is we need to have an assembling real soon about U.S.-Africa policy the last 100 years. Mm. And we need to get every organization in our community that has done work in Africa, whatever it is, the churches, the universities, the business organizations, the civic organizations, the grassroots organizations, they need to just come in there and provide on record what they have done on the ground on the African continent. And then we can determine what is beneficial and what is detrimental, just based on the naked data. Let the Honorable Elijah Muhammad told Malcolm X, let the people choose, put the clean glass next to the dirty glass. It's only these cowards now who want to engage in spectrum regulation and have these assemblings talking about the state of our people, but they leave particular demographics off the spectrum. So, and some of them are intellectually paranoid. Some of them have been told by the master that's what they damn well better do. And others are just making sure that they don't want Joe Biden's face to look like a beetroot in the morning. So they've got a multitude of reasons why they play these silly games. But we're going to stop all that, though. I'm confident.
You know, Ellie, brother brought up something in bringing up about this forum. I like the idea, you know, that I like to ask Sister Cherie, because in if her, do she see her, I'm going to call it a project, correct me if I'm wrong, of we charge colonialism as a foreign policy initiative that that we should be embracing as a part of our foreign policy toolkit?
Absolutely. I think that it's common for us to discuss American racism within the confines of Jim Crow and obviously American slavery, but we don't connect the dots that those systems are systems of colonialism. Mm-hmm. And the systems that exist today are an extension of colonialism. The reason why we started the organization is because, well, one, our organization is Pan-Africanist, so we've always looked at it from an international sphere. And two, because we feel as though a lot of us disconnect our struggle in America from the struggle of Africans all over the world. And the way that we do that is by differentiating colonialism from what happened to us. But when you look at why colonialism was done, it was for the enrichment of Europe, the same way that American chattel slavery is for the enrichment of the elite in America. When you look at how systems of racism operate, colonialism has always been the predominant method of oppression of Africans in the United States. So that was really our thought, that we wanted to make that, you know, I think it's something when you think about it, it's easy to grasp, but the problem is I hardly ever hear that being spoken of whenever I'm seeing people who are supposed to represent us inside of public spaces. I hardly ever hear colonialism. And it's obvious why, because the second that we become aware of our situation as being a colonized people, that puts us inside of the same place as Africans outside of the United States. And obviously the United States government has always tried to separate us from foreign affairs. And so that was our thinking of that.
She and our sister's exactly right. But and at the same time, they use us. Every time he decides to poke his chest out, Harry Belafonte talks about how he took SNCC to Guinea in 1964. And he said he wanted to give them a break from Mississippi just to clear their head. Not true. He was sent to Guinea by John F. Kennedy as a special emissary representing the United States Peace Corps. And the goal was to convince Agnès-Sékou Touré to get the Guinean Ballet to develop a cultural exchange program. He initially agreed till he found out where Mr. Belafonte was really coming from. And so a couple of years into the agreement, he just pulled back and said, thanks, but no thanks. We can't continue this. What it is when we have this conversation, when we put this focus, we're going to be disgusted by the relationships that U.S.-born Africans, through their organized formations, what they have supported in the past and what they're presently doing. UNITA had support in this country, in Angola. Matter of fact, Bayard Rustin said that supported UNITA, and the reason that he said he was supporting UNITA, and this is when him and the founder of the National Endowment for Democracy, Carl Gershman, were working together. And he said We have to support UNITA and Angola for one reason, to stop the influence of Cuba in Southern Africa. This is Bayard Rustin, the civil rights icon, who with A. Philip Randolph were the first ones to call for the March on Washington in 1941. So when we take the fact that every time we share with people the Congressional Black Caucus's position on Zimbabwe, people are about to vomit. This is going on. When people hear what Susan Rice, in pushing for AFRICOM the way she did, she said her motivation for doing it is because Africa has been getting a free ride with the humanitarian aid. But of course, we go back to what Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah showed us. After neocolonialism, the last stage of imperialism, was published, $33 million in humanitarian aid that was supposed to go to Ghana was canceled by the United States government. The Eritrean government, 9 years ago, became the first nation in the world to expel the United States Agency from International Development, which was created, Brother Elliot, the same year the Peace Corps was. And that's the number one enemy to Africa today. If we can run them off the African continent, we're doing well. This is why next month we're announcing a push to create a resource pool for Cuba's medical efforts on the African continent. This will destabilize the Red Cross. This will neutralize Doctors Without Borders, which is CIA agents in disguise. Our activity will magnify these contradictions. We can give our people an alternative. That way, when we give them an alternative, they can make an informed choice. So we're confident. We're happy. You see young sisters like these young sisters you're listening to today. You're listening to young old people like myself. Things are going to take a turn for the better. We just have to keep fighting. We just have to keep organizing. And the projects and campaigns and initiatives that we're able to initiate and sustain will be the clearest illustrator of what we're fighting for and where we're going. Thank you so much for including me in this awesome conversation.
Listen, we're going to take a brief break. If you can stay a few more minutes, that'd be good.
Yeah, I can hang for a minute. I was late, so I can hang for a minute.
Okay, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we got some calls on the line. Maybe they want to get involved, but you can get involved, too, while we still have our guests by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. We're talking an African-centered perspective to U.S. African foreign policy. Our guest is a researcher and author, Larae Muhammad, African Esquire TV host, Sister Tierney Cherie, and organizer, journalist, and playwright, and U.S. correspondent to The Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Igbona Jr. And again, you can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 21-
215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometz U Black family, to join your interconnected Kometz U Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
In this crooked game of power politics here in America, the Negro, namely the race problem, integration, civil rights issue, are all nothing but tools used by the whites who call themselves liberals against another group of whites who call themselves conservatives, either to get into power or to retain power. Among whites here in America, the political teams are no longer divided into Democrats and Republicans. The whites who are now struggling for control of the American political throne are divided into liberal and conservative camps. The white liberals from both parties cross party lines to work together toward the same goal. And white conservatives from both parties do likewise. The white liberal differs from the white conservative only in one way. The liberal is more deceitful, more hypocritical than the conservative. Both want power, but the white liberal is the one who has perfected the art of posing as the Negro's friend and benefactor. And by winning the friendship and support of the Negro, the white liberal is able to use the Negro as a pawn or a weapon in this political football game that is constantly raging between the white liberals and the white conservatives. The American Negro is nothing but a political football.
Since the 60s, you will see nothing but betrayals by the petty bourgeois elements in our society. The African bourgeoisie is the most corrupt bourgeoisie in the world. In Africa, they seek luxury in the midst of mass suffering. There are more Mercedes in Africa than in any other continent in the world. In America, as soon as they arrive at a position based on the blood of the people, they snatch that position and run away from the people. But you must not think that they represent the people. They only represent their opportunistic self using the people every step of the way. So you must not be confused. The petty bourgeoisie everywhere will be running for cover, but the masses will spare them not. Consequently, we who have dedicated our lives to the people's struggle, we, who knowing that the people will always be free, we, understanding that we must make a contribution to qualify our struggle since the 60s, have been dedicating all our energies to only one task, the organization of the masses of our people. We are not running for mayor. We're not running for president. No changes can come from the top down. We're not stupid. Changes can only come from the bottom up. The masses and the masses alone can make them. If you want to learn something from the 60s, the lesson is simple. Organize the masses of the people. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're the one who put
the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. A political chump. The party that you bash controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and still they can't keep their promise to you, because you're a chump. Anytime you throw your weight behind a political party that controls two-thirds of the government, and that party can't keep the promise that it made to you during election time, and you are dumb enough to walk around continuing to identify yourself with that party, you're not only a chump, but you're a traitor to your race.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 9:10 here in the city of Philadelphia. And we're in conversation with our special guest this evening, researcher and author, Sister Lorraine Muhammad, African Esquire TV host, Sister Tierney Cherie, and organizer, journalist, and playwright, U.S. correspondent to the Herald, Brother Obi Igbona Jr. The topic, an African-centered perspective on U.S. and African foreign policy. You can get involved in the conversation for the time we have left by dialing 215-490-9832. Again, that's 215-490-9832. Let me take this call. I've been waiting for a while. Let's go to 4444.
Hey, Elliot, you hear me? How you hear me? You hear me?
Yes, sir.
You Obuna, but look here, man. My man Malcolm X is right, man. I study counterintelligence program, man. And I keep trying to tell my people, with this red and blue, Republican, Democrat, they working together, man. Okay? And it's hard for our people to see that. Prince told us that. Red and blue is purple. That's why we got the purple rain now. They working together. But my man, Obi, you said something about Bill Rustin, right? I checked your dossier, man. Bill Rustin was working with J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, man. He was a spy for the FBI, man, for him to talk to King to be nonviolent, man. Okay, so Bill Rustin was a spy, and I seen the dossier. I seen Elliot them a couple of years back. And one more thing to my sister, she right on with the military, but we should go raise them one thing further. No black should be paying no damn taxes, man. Okay, why in the hell would we finance our own debt, man? Every time you pay a $1 tax dollar, you're paying the police to kill you. Okay, what y'all think about that, Elliot? I'm coming on strong now because you wasn't there fighting, so I got to break it, man.
Listen, Richard, you heard the brother.
I don't have nothing to say.
Wes, listen, you always give good contributions to the program, and I would I don't have no problem with what you're saying about Bed Rusted. I mean, it's been out there, and it's information to show that he worked and was a paid informant of the FBI.
It is counterintelligence program, man. That's why they paid opposition, man. That's what they do. So the Black Lives Matter, they paid opposition too. And I love y'all, man. Hey, Obi, I love you, man. I love you, bro. I love your vibe, man. So I'm drop the mic. And I love my sister now. But we got to quit paying taxes, man. Okay? Peace and blessing, man. Because I know something what they're coming up with, but I'd say that for another show, man.
All right. Okay?
I love y'all. Peace and blessing. Stay strong. Stay black.
Thank you for your call.
Take care now.
Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Let's go to Washington, D.C. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from? Are you there? Let me set the way. Let's go to New York City. New York City? I think she's playing a radio in the background. Let's go to New York City again. 347. 347?
Can I raise something while we...
Go ahead, Richard.
You know, and it's... Brother Obi, and all of you have really, you know, for me, you know, helped flush out how we're supposed to, you know, really look at our engagement with foreign policy. And I feel, and giving solutions to it. And I might be regressing with this, but I guess it is bothering me. And I don't like bringing them up, but it does upset me. And that is Israel's involvement in the continent, or at least placing as a nation state, placing itself as a critical element. And we know the relationship between even with this recent assassination that they just, this technological assassination that they just pulled off, the relationship between Israel and the United States is beyond the pale. And we know with these political operatives, you know, every one of them has to give their, I mean, it's worse than the mafia. I mean, when you hear some of the statements that they make as they support, and I'm talking about whether it's the now bright vice president or the one who may become, you know, may become the speaker, or any of them, how they speak when it comes to their support for the state of Israel. But when it comes to what they're doing in relationship to African countries, and I'm looking at this a part of the report where it says in recent years, Israel has been making great strides to mend severed relationship with the continent. That is the overreaching goal, to win Africa to Israel's side. In a 2017 meeting with Israel ambassadors to Africa, Netanyahu was unequivocal. The first interest is to dramatically change the situation regarding Africans' vote at the UN and other international bodies from opposition to support. So when I see Greenfield now being placed as the UN, as the U.S. ambassador at the UN, I'm asking this question. Do you think that gives her skin presence or phenotype, and as you mentioned, Brother Obi, her relationship with Madeleine Albright in that center gives the negotiating process, the furthering that with the African countries in order to give Israel, I think they're looking for a seat in the 6th district. I might be wrong with that, but it seems that that's where they're going. Do y'all think that that's something that we need to be critically, those of us who are looking at from a Pan-African view, be critically aware and speak to in relationship to Israel's positioning with the continent? Anyone can speak to it if it's relevant.
Sister still on?
I'm
still here, yes.
Sister Ray?
Yeah, they can.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Israel has a lot of aspirations that Netanyahu is putting forth, but at the end of the day, none of this is going to pan out. Because just because the leadership sides with Israel doesn't mean that the masses of the people in those countries are going to agree. So it might actually be, and they're not in their best interest in the long run, because it might cause the masses of the people to turn against the leadership, which are not doing what the people want them to do. They're on their own thing, because a lot of the people on the street are saying that they're not pro-Israel. So if you're sitting as the president or the prime minister or whatever your title is, and you're saying you're pro-Israel, that's going to cause some friction. I guess that they're offering, they must be offering them something for all of them all of a sudden to be stepping up and being pro-Israel. I think Sudan recently, a few countries that now are pro-Israel. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's going to really hold water, especially with the youth who know what Israel is doing, to the Palestinian people. I don't think that that's going to continue to be a situation it's not tenable, as far as I'm concerned. It's not going to be something that's going to continue. They're just doing that for whatever propaganda. They tend to put things out that they want you to believe. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. And I'll just leave it at that.
How do you say it, Sister Serene?
I also believe that, I believe it's actually completely contrary to Africa's interests. It seems as though any type of interaction Israel wants to have with Africa is more so to be a satellite of the United States. Every single policy that I've ever seen in, when it comes to Israel and Africa, it's always been Israel standing with the white supremacist structure. Mm-hmm. Israel obviously supported the regime in South Africa. Every single time that you see about African liberations, you hear about Israeli intelligence being involved. I've never seen a time where Israel was in support of decolonization or anything that would be to the interests of Africans. So I think that them trying to become closer to the African Union as they are is just a way to try to become closer to have the U.S. influence be closer in Africa. And with that, actually, if you don't mind, I actually have to tend to my son, but thank you for having me on the program.
Sister Cherie, thanks for being with us, and we'll reach out to you soon.
Thank you.
Talk to you later. Peace.
It's been a pleasure.
You know, Brother Obi, okay, weigh in on it.
Yeah. Oh, come on now. Now, this whole, that was just a smokescreen too, because a couple of years ago, I think Brother Richard, if that's what he was talking about, Ghana pushed for Israel to join the African Union as an observer member.
Right.
And so that's where the issue came in. Now, it goes back in terms of the historical context. I mean, come on. When Algeria and Tunisia gained their independence from French colonialism, the only country that stood up and refused to acknowledge their sovereignty at the UN was the Zionist State of Israel. Israel's support of the apartheid South African regime, the German colonial regime in Namibia, and the Portuguese colonialist regimes in Angola and Mozambique tell you everything. When a naive senator out of Illinois named Barack Obama wrote George Bush a letter in 2006 saying, don't lift sanctions on Zimbabwe until the dark cloud of Robert Mugabe is ousted from power, he was pushed by none other than Tom Lantos, the late Zionist that was in the U.S. Congress, who's the same one who repudiated Khalid Muhammad on the floors of the United States Congress. And of course, once again, from the left to the center to the right, some of our people have always, I was in an organization called the Pan-African Student Youth United Front, and which became the Pan-African Student Youth Movement 30 years ago. And we were the first student formation to join the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front. And that was initiated in Libya at the end of 1990. And it lasted for about 6 or 7 years. And it was a Pan-African umbrella of organizations that were pushing the question of Zionism as a direct enemy of African people. Palestinian solidarity is a given. And this is building on the momentum of Brother Malcolm, who during his time in getting Muhammad Speaks off the ground, they had a segment that covered the Palestinian issue. And then, of course, this is why the final call today has the Middle East report with Ali Baghdadi. And then, of course, what led to the demise of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was Ethel Miner's paper, The Palestinian Problem, which led SNCC to support Egypt and Syria when Israel tried to take Kemet off the map. So Israel actually owes Africa reparations for their genocidal policies and them being in concert with those who have committed genocide against the African continent. And so that remains our focus. But and at the same time, those who are in the center have tried to break bread with the Zionists, play the violin for the Zionists, and have had other diplomatic overtures where they want to have a civil dialogue with Zionists in the religious sector, Zionists in the political sector, Zionists in the business sector. And interestingly enough, in the early, in the 1990s, when we were trying to build our worldwide African anti-Zionist front in this country, many of the main people that you saw on podiums, banging podiums, like bass drums during a marching band, they were not interested at all in joining the worldwide African anti-Zionist front for whatever the reasons were. Kwame Ture did everything he could to persuade the Nation of Islam to join. I remember having a meeting with Khalid Abdul-Muhammad when he was still in the Nation of Islam, saying, is this something that he could push for in his influential capacity? He wasn't interested either. So part of this effort is to get the most militant position on Israel. But remember, after Durban Ball 2001, when the Bush administration said our captivity, Palestine and reparations should not be part of the agenda, people began to witness a resurgence of solidarity with the Palestinians. However, then Jimmy Carter opportunistically begins to call for, he compared Israel to South Africa during apartheid. But the most militant forces in the world have been anti-Zionist, will remain anti-Zionist. So on a Pan-African scale, we've always tried to merge the resistance against Zionism on the African continent with resistance against Zionism in the diaspora, wherever it manifests itself. And as we go after the United States, as we go after the other, our former colonizers, Israel must not be spared one second. But that requires the ultimate courage and the ultimate fight. And understand, you're going to clash with many who are heroes. Mm-hmm. Bringing him up once again, Harry Belafonte, the same way that Thurgood Marshall brags about making it a mandate in Kenya's constitution, the Kenyans had to buy their land back from the British. Harry Belafonte takes pride in popularizing a song called Hava Nagila. If you've ever seen Harry Belafonte perform, he always sings that song. He sings that song with more passion than Ray Charles sings America the Beautiful. And what that song is it's a celebration of the Balfour Declaration. And Lord, the Balfour Declaration is what laid the foundation for the Zionist State of Israel to be established. You can look up Harry Belafonte singing that song. And and we believe before he transitions, because we hear he's very ill, so, you know, we hope he's getting better. But before he leaves this earth, he needs to tell us if he was the one to persuade Dr. Martin Luther King, the most peaceful man the front line has ever produced, to support the Zionist State of Israel during the Six-Day War. How was Dr. King, who took whippings from Bull Connor, whippings from Jim Clark, whippings from the Klan, terrorized on every level, had his house bombed, and demanded we stay nonviolent no matter what. Who could persuade Dr. King to come out in favor of Israel in the Six-Day War? The biggest blemish on his record. So this whole thing of being soft on Zionism, being inconsistent on Zionism, being disingenuous on Zionism, that ain't nothing new. But what we have to do is we have to bring this question to the table. And enough of this whole thing of sitting at the table. Let's just put the work on the table that everyone's doing, and let's objectively choose what has the most militant fervor and tenacity. And let's just go with that.
Listen, two things before we kind of start moving into the final phase of the program. I want to mention, because one of it deals with the work you're doing. Two mm-hmm. things. We see that the diplomatic arm of the U.S., which includes mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton at the time when she addressed the 54 African countries, and the mm-hmm. diplomats and the core workers or whoever, is pushing homosexuality on the continent. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton made it clear when she told them under the instructions of Obama that if they didn't start accepting homosexuality and relaxing the laws, banning that behavior, that they mm-hmm. wouldn't get aid from the United States. Mm-hmm. And some of our people see things that's happening on the continent. And I'm kind of mm-hmm. relating this to Brother Obi, because you do work on the continent and as a journalist in Zimbabwe. When our mm-hmm. people see things happening on the continent here, they look and have a critical eye of things going on when they see some of the governments capitulated to the U.S., some of them capitulated to Israel. But what I'm saying is this. The same problems that our people are facing and dealing with there of corrupt politicians or politicians that want to assimilate or capitulate to the West is the same things we're dealing with here. I mean, talk about that from your perspective on both of those fronts. And Sister Ray Muhammad, I want you to weigh in too, because as a woman dealing with this, they're approaching women from a different perspective because they're putting women in the forefront of a lot of these movements, especially here and of recent, maybe over the past year and a half, Black women are being pushed to the front. So talk about that from your perspective.
Sir. Yeah, go ahead, sister.
I'm speaking first?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
We have to remember that we outnumber them 10 or 13 to 1 numerically, so they'll do whatever they have to do to reduce our population. Homosexuality was one of the strategies that they decided to use to keep our population low because, of course, a male and a male and a female cannot reproduce. So because the goal for them is depopulation, they'll do whatever they have to do to depopulate. That's the reason why they're giving us over these injections. They're offering now the COVID vaccine. We don't know what's in that. And we've been advised by the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan not to take their vaccine because they produced it very quickly. You can't sue them if you drop dead. And they don't even know if the thing is going to work. We don't know. If we know that it's just not in our best interest to take anything that they give us, because think of the Tuskegee incident, the Tuskegee experiment, all these different things that they've done. They were sterilizing young girls in Africa and giving them shots that sterilized them. And they were sterilizing these young ladies at 14 and 15 years old. So we don't know what's in these vaccines, but we do know that they're interested under Kissinger and other programs. They want to reduce the population. When I was taking a class in college, they were saying they had a class for overpopulation at Queens College, and I took the class. But at the end of the semester, they had to admit that the population wasn't the problem. The problem was they didn't want to redistribute the wealth. So we want to hoard the wealth as Europeans, then what are we going to do with this group of people who we're not going to share the wealth with? So that means we have to do something about them. So they don't see they don't have a problem with capitalism because capitalism, they get to keep everything, but they know that they have to deal with the people who are not going to benefit from capitalism. So they've decided pretty much any policy that reduce our populations here and abroad, they're willing to do. And remember, you're dealing with psychopaths. So if you think that these are things that they would not do, anything that you think they wouldn't do, trust me, they're willing to do.
Okay. Well, in terms of what you said about homosexuality, it gets more attention than it deserves. I have three words: tolerance over advocacy. And tolerance simply means that you acknowledge that something exists in the world. Advocacy is when you promote it like it's something you embrace and you practice. Muslims advocate Islam. Christians advocate Christianity. Jews advocate Judaism. How can heterosexuals be on the front line for advocating homosexuality? It's not what they practice. So if it's, and then also, it comes down to an ideological question for us. J. Edgar Hoover was the scum of the earth. He was a homosexual. James Baldwin is one of the most important fighters in the Cultural Army that we've ever had. He was a homosexual. They both are homosexual. They both are fighting for different things. So this notion that all homosexuals are lumped together, they think alike, they move alike, they function alike. On the front line is the ultimate equalizer. It's the only place where a fifth grade dropout like the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, an eighth grade dropout like Malcolm X can be right next to PhDs like Du Bois and Carter G. Woodson and fight and organize. So whatever people's preference is, what they do in private, on the battlefield, that's not a thing. they're always trying to impose their cultural models on the rest of the world. That's one of the best, most powerful vehicles imperialism has, cultural imposition. To make an analogy, since 1983, the National Endowment for Democracy, the National Democratic Institute, and the International Republican Institute have been going all over the world saying that they're giving people civilized democracy. Isn't that what they say when they go to Africa and observe elections and go to the Caribbean and observe elections? But look, who are these people in Africa? Who's Catherine Samba Panza? Who's Joyce Banda? Who's Ellen Johnson Sirleaf? Isn't the current president of Ethiopia a woman? Mm-hmm. South Africa had a woman president for 18 hours. The Central African Republic has had about three or four women prime ministers. Mali's had a woman president. Liberia had Africa's first woman president. Zimbabwe had modern Africa's first woman vice president. So by their definition, our democracy in Africa is more civilized than theirs, because Hillary Clinton was deprived of her ultimate political fantasy to be the president of the United States of America, because the culture of the United States does not accept it. So they're going to continue to try to impose their culture linguistically, impose their culture through religious and spiritual expression. So why would we think that they wouldn't try to impose their culture in terms of social behavior criteria and modalities? It's a given. But we're tolerant of everything and everyone, but we only advocate what we're willing to die for.
You know, before I let you go and wind things down, Brother Obi and Sister LaRae, we see now that this COVID-19 is raging out of control, especially in Europe and the United States. This vaccine has been rushed on the scene. In fact, it's kind of funny. When the idiot that's leaving office now, when he was saying a couple of months ago that the vaccine will be out by December, all of his European brethren were saying, oh, he's crazy, what is he talking about? And now it's here. So, and now you see that politicians, the black ministry in a lot of these cities is stepping forward. And in fact, on some of the HBCU college campuses, they were telling some of the deans to encourage the students to take this vaccine. We see that the black ministers in several cities, black ministerial organizations have been encouraging black folks to take this vaccine. And now black people seeing their savior get on, make a published report saying that he's willing to go on television and be shot up with the vaccine. And I'm being sarcastic when I'm talking about Obama. But I think him and, if I'm not mistaken, Richard, him, Bush, and Clinton.
Was it Clinton?
Yeah, I think it's Clinton. Yeah. Said that they would all three go on TV and be shot up with this vaccine. So, but I heard you say earlier about the movement afoot to, because you've always been working with the Cuban doctors and what they've been doing with the Alpha Interferon B. Talk about it from your perspective, Obi, because you mentioned it earlier in the conversation, but I want you to hit that again before we leave.
Yeah. I mean, it just comes down to whenever we object to something, what is the alternative? Cuba has the alternative. Since March, we've been pushing for Cuban medical personnel, the Henry Reed Medical International Brigade, to come to this country. We're going to continue to push for it. We thank the Nation of Islam for publishing a special expose on our work 2 months ago, Brother Brian Muhammad out of Richmond, Virginia. And we thank the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan for bringing attention to our efforts in his last public remarks for a long time, as he said. So we're just going to continue to work. We're going to continue to organize. And so the lines are drawn. Those who believe in the health care, because it comes down to the path of reform or revolution. Those who are pushing this vaccination, they are fighting for health care reform. Those who are telling you to defund the police as opposed to de-weaponize these pigs, they're fighting for police reform. They're those who are fighting for education reform. The dominant sentiment in our community especially those who are trying to use the blood we shed to eradicate racism, to climb the ladder of capitalism, they believe capitalism can be reformed. The same way that people believed in South Africa, apartheid can be reformed. The same way there were those who believed that settler colonialism could be reformed. Those amongst the oppressed believe the system imposed on them by the oppressor can be reformed. So people who are pushing for reform, they're going to push for reform. What are we going to do? Is, are we going to push for revolution? Are we going to allow that to discourage us? Or are we going to allow that to be the ultimate motivator? It's just that simple. We're motivated, we're inspired, we're driven. We're going to fight for what we believe. They're going to fight for what they believe. It's going to come down to discipline. It's going to come down to focus. It's going to come down to concentration. That's it.
Brother Obi, Sister Leray, I want to thank both of you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's very healthy and helpful in order to have this dialogue. I hope we continue to be able to flesh this out and develop it.
Sister Ray, I'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
Peace.
Take care.
All right.
Peace.
Richard, interesting dialogue, man. It's just interesting to see, you know, I'm looking at this subject that we was talking about and seeing some of the names of people and what they've been doing behind, so-called behind the scenes, because they're not letting the black public know what's involved. You know, some of these folks, now I'm just reading the published report. This is from 2017. As a black guy out of Atlanta. Now, this is from 2017. He's no longer in that position now. In fact, he's in a more powerful position. But let me read this, Richard, because it's interesting. And we were just talking about this. African-American State Department staff member who has been an operative for both the Republican and Democratic National Committees have been appointed to the position within the Peace Corps, the organization has announced. Ashley Bell had served as a special assistant to Secretary of State Rex Tillerson before his appointment last month to a post of Associate Director of External Affairs of the Peace Corps, according to Gainesville, Georgia Times. He's the first political appointee to the Peace Corps. Peace Corps volunteers, first political appointee to the police corps by the Trump administration. Now, this was from 2017, mind you. It says, the Peace Corps volunteers represent the best United States have to offer, and I am grateful for the opportunity to support the agency founded in American ideals of serving others, Bell said in a statement. As head of external affairs, my hope is to highlight the vital role of the Peace Corps plays an irrevocable change to the lives of both volunteers and the communities they help. Bell has a long history in politics on both sides of the aisle. First as a delegate for the Democratic National Convention in 2000, a superdelegate in 2004. He switched parties in 2010, telling Fox News at the time that his stance as a conservative Democrat had become an oxymoron. When Democrats have full control of all government, it basically shows that the left side of the party is going to run everywhere, he told the network. When Obamacare happened, I couldn't stay. So we see here that these people that's involved in foreign policy, Richard, it's no Democrat and Republican. They play both sides of the aisle. If you remember that clip that we both listened to of the current UN ambassador, Thomas Greenfield, she said that those agencies always benefit from bipartisan support. So it's no argument going back and forth about Democrats and Republicans. They all push those things everything that deals with those type of issues of foreign policy always has bipartisan support. So it was kind of funny here that this young brother, was appointed to this position under Trump, then been involved in both political parties and in high positions in both political parties.
So now, understanding there's a representative of the state, not the party.
Exactly. And now he's going to be involved. Now he was involved. I don't think he's involved anymore in the Peace Corps. Something we was just talking about earlier.
Right.
Here's another bill that passed with bipartisan support that deals sort of with what we were talking about tonight. And this is from 3 months ago, but it's interesting when you see the players involved. Harris, Coons, Wicker, and colleagues introduced a bill to expand national service opportunities and uplift communities. Washington, D.C. U.S. Senator Kamala Harris on Tuesday joined with Chris Coons, Democrat, Roger Wicker, Republican from Mississippi, along with Cory Booker, Democrat, and Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, and Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, and Hyde Smith, Republican from Mississippi, to introducing bipartisan legislation to expand national service programs. To help economic and social crises facing the nation. The act would double the number of AmeriCorps positions available this year from 150,000 and to provide 600,000 service positions nationwide over the next 3 years to unemployed youth and others looking to assist their communities. AmeriCorps members have a long history of service to our communities, and now more than ever, the country is relying on public service as we continue to address our problems. Senator Kamala Harris said, "We must expand national service opportunities and ensure that every American who wants to serve be able to do this at this critical time." Mm-hmm. Chris Coons, thousands of young people across the country are calling for greater opportunity and for new meaningful engagement to address present inequities. Now it is time to mobilize that energy to make our community stronger and healthier for everyone. The Corps Act will empower Americans to give back to their communities. Now that was Chris Coons and quotes from Kamala Harris on this legislation. Cory Booker, this was his quotes. AmeriCorps volunteers has been helping strengthen neighborhoods for decades. Amidst these tumultuous times, expanding national service programs like AmeriCorps will aid our nation. Lindsey Graham, a focus on local rebuilding efforts and community service will pay dividends for our nation. This is why I support the legislation. America's at the crossroads, and people are eager to get to work in service to uplift the communities and the nation. This legislation will help national service to uplift people and communities and strengthen our democracy. U.S. Senator Jack Reed, who helped create the Bipartisan National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service. So, I'll read Marco Rubio's quote. "I am proud to join the Senate colleagues in introducing this legislation to help Americans, especially Americans facing unemployment, contribute to our recovery by serving their local communities." So this bill, Richard, AmeriCorps, by getting into the communities, creating the, what it says here, teaching efforts, what is it? It mentions some of the things, rebuilding communities by, I lost my place on this thing.
I think that teachers, primarily teachers, they work for the school system in order to gain their
Yeah, credit. It says assisting students with remote education, and helping assist students with remote education and helping people make critical healthcare decisions. So if you're talking about AmeriCorps assisting, where's these programs in the inner city? And plus, you got bipartisan legislators pushing this, both Democrat and Republican. And from black elected officials running around, the Republicans are their enemies. Everybody's supposed to be Democrat. So how are these people working together with anything that's going to benefit the masses of black people? That doesn't even make any sense.
It's another way to create a military corps without calling it that.
Exactly. It all works hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to, some of our people to start looking deeply at this type of stuff, because when we see these black faces being appointed to these positions, a lot of times some of our people get excited because they're seeing a black face. But these people don't serve their interests. They have no interest in the masses of black people. Their interest is pushing American exceptionalism and American imperialism. That's all. At all costs.
That's a fact.
Next week, I want to, because we don't have time now, I want to play that clip for the listening audience from Alan Bosack. In reference to Barack Obama, because now excerpts are coming out from his book that's interesting. I'll put it that way. It's not surprising at all, but it's just interesting. So maybe we'll get to talking about some of that probably the next program. Before we leave tonight, you want to say something, Richard?
No.
Before we leave tonight, let me go over the lineup for Time for an Awakening Media. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie. Always interesting dialogue and conversation on African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. from 6 to 8. Later on Monday evenings, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed. From 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central, with host Dr. Maria Kamban and Sister Nataki Kamban. And from 9 to 10, Encovage Program, Conversation Reparations. And I think they were supposed to start last week, so they'll be starting sometime this month, put it that way. On Tuesday, from 8 to 10, in evenings, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers. On Friday, Time for An Awakening is back from 8 until. Then on Saturdays, from 4 to 6, Black Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. Later on that Saturday evening from 7 to 9, the Elders of Sankofa with host Alfonso Watkins. And then Sunday, Time for an Awakening is back from 7 until. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world.
such a small part of.
Children, to save the children.